The Braden Scale for Predicting Pressure Ulcer Risk, today on the podcast.
The Nursing Home Abuse Podcast is dedicated to providing news and information for families whose loved ones have been injured in a nursing home. Here are your hosts, Georgia attorneys Rob Schenck and Will Smith.
Hi there, welcome back to the show. My name is Rob. I will be your host this particular episode. If you are enjoying the content of the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast, please be sure to like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts from. And if you're watching this on YouTube, please be sure to like and subscribe. Leave a comment in the comment section if you're enjoying it or if you have any questions. We appreciate any feedback that you got. As a consequence of feedback, because we get a lot of questions about pressure ulcers, we wanted to have an episode dedicated to pressure ulcer assessment. We've talked about treatment. We've talked about the anatomical and physiological causes of pressure ulcers in the past. This time, we wanted to actually really kind of do a deeper assessment on the assessment. We wanted to do a deeper dive on how people can be assessed for their risk of developing pressure ulcers. One of the universal assessment tools used by nursing homes across the country is the Braden Scale. And today on the podcast, we have Dr. Nancy Bergstrom, who was one of the developers of the Braden Scale. And it's called the Braden Scale, but it's copyrighted as the Braden and Bergstrom Scale. And so we were so lucky that we were able to get Dr. Bergstrom on the show to talk about pressure ulcer assessments in general, but the Braden Scale in particular. Dr. Nancy Bergstrom received her PhD from the University of Michigan. Prior to her retirement, she served as professor at the University of Nebraska Medical Center in Omaha and as the Trumbull Professor of Aging Research and Director of the Center on Aging at the University of Texas Health Science Center, Houston. As a mouthful. Her research for more than 30 years focused on predicting and preventing pressure ulcers. Dr. Bergstrom and Dr. Braden created the Braden Scale for predicting pressure ulcer risk and conducted numerous studies of reliability and validity and clinical utility of the Braden Scale. Dr. Bergstrom chaired the U.S. Government Agency for Healthcare Policy and Research Panel, creating the first guidelines for pressure ulcer prediction and prevention. More recently, she focused on clinical studies to improve patient safety through pressure ulcer prevention. And we're, again, super lucky to have her on the show. Dr. Bergstrom, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Fantastic. I am excited to have you on the show. We've had numerous episodes about pressure ulcers and information that families can use with regard to helping prevent the risk of pressure ulcer development in their loved ones in nursing homes. And I was excited to have you on because this is one of your areas of expertise. Within that subcategory, you are highly knowledgeable about the process by which a nursing home, a nursing facility, is going to assess and evaluate an individual's risk of developing pressure ulcers, because you can correct me if I'm wrong, not everybody is at the same type of risk of developing this type of wound. So if you can just, from a 40,000 foot view, when a resident comes into or is admitted into a nursing home, why is a pressure ulcer, a skin integrity risk assessment, why is it important, and what all is kind of involved in that process?
Let me back up one step and tell you, when I was just a student nurse and then was a graduate student, I took care of people with pressure ulcers, and I kept saying, why on earth can't we prevent these things instead of treating them? It just doesn't make any sense. And as I grew in my career, came to know someone, and we worked together and developed an instrument to help us predict who would get a pressure ulcer, not so we could predict it, but so that we could prevent them. So we were really eager to find a way to prevent pressure ulcers. Check when we started this, pressure ulcers were considered, and there was an article about this, the scourge of nursing homes. And so that's where we entered the picture, wanting to decrease the incidence of pressure ulcers and remove people, you know, from being at such great risk so we could reduce the overall number of pressure ulcers in nursing homes.
Exactly. So it's, I guess, from, like, that's why it's important that right out of the gate, like, not necessarily like 6 weeks later, but almost right out of the gate, you know, there's right. there's the facility going, bam, 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 here's a checklist. So let me ask this. Is there some type of, is there a uniform system of assessing residents? Like, would nursing home A assess a resident for pressure ulcer development in the same way that nursing home B would do that?
Well, we would like to think that we offer the opportunity for uniformity. We developed the Braden scale for predicting pressure sore risk and it was copyrighted in 1988. And over the many years, we've done a lot of research in this area, and our work has been published pretty widely. So our instrument is used pretty much in most continents around the world. So the overall goal we had was to provide a way for people to jump in and do a quick assessment of pressure ulcer risk.
Exactly. So, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Go ahead.
Oh, no, you didn't. Go ahead.
I was going to say, you've said the word Braden assessment. For people out there that are not familiar with that, what does that mean? Is that a specific, is it the person's name, this type of thing?
Sure. Barbara Braden and I started working together in the early 80s, and she had begun to develop a tool, which then we together did many, many years of NIH-funded research to describe the tool and to provide evidence of the predictive validity and usefulness of the tool. So the Braden scale, what it does is it simplifies the risk assessment. If many people would tell you a big long list of things that would lead a person to be at risk for pressure ulcers, what we've done is to conceptualize it so that many of those risk factors fall into one category. For instance, if somebody had limited mobility, if we were using an expanded checklist, we might go through something like stroke, hip replacement, fracture, hip, arthritis, paraplegia, whatever. But what we've looked at is mobility. Can this person move? Or activity, can they get out of bed? And so we tried to synthesize it down into six small subscales that not only identify the risk factors, but attempt to assign a level of severity of the risk factors so that can guide clinical practice.
And just for our listeners, I have to ask questions, even though I know the answer to them, but just letting you know to the listeners out there that Dr. Bergstrom and Dr. Braden and this Braden assessment is kind of like the gold standard. It is a widely used tool, and she's being very humble, but it's been critical in many nursing homes across the country in assessing individuals for skin integrity. But Dr. Bergstrom, you had mentioned assessing mobility, these type of things. Can you, just from a broad standpoint, what are the other categories? So for example, would someone's cognitive capacity, would somebody's mental capacity, would that relate into the assessment? And then from there, how does that relate to the final analysis? Like, is it a numbered thing? Like this person is a 10 out of a 10, or is it like high, medium, low, this type of thing? Can you kind of go through those categories and kind of explain at the end of the day, what is that document going to tell us?
Sure. I'd be happy to do that. Well, first of all, let's talk about how we conceptualize this whole big area. So we boiled it down to two things in the end. How much pressure is being applied to the skin and by the bony prominences and the surfaces upon which a person is lying. And we're going to say that not everybody is alike. Everybody's tissue may have a different response. So we call this tissue tolerance. So I almost wish I had sent you one of our conceptual frameworks. It might be easier to follow. But pressure, we have three categories to it. One is sensory perception, another mobility, and activity. Sensory perception says, can this person feel? But it also says, if they can feel, are they conscious enough to be able to seek help if they need that? So a mental status, whether they're confused or whether they're not able to respond at all to stimuli, does play a part. So does the ability to feel and perceive touch. So that's one risk factor. And as I said before, mobility, the ability to even turn themselves in bed, may influence whether or not they can release pressure naturally for themselves. The other risk factor then is activity. Does that person get up and move about on their own? So all of those things are determinants of whether or not they could be exposed to pressure. But then we have the matter of tissue tolerance. How much does the individual characteristics have a factor in how much pressure can be tolerated? And we look at this as well from the inside, from the extrinsic factors first, from the outside. And it might be things like moisture. If the person is wet a lot, whether that be from incontinence, perspiration, sweat because it's hot in the nursing home or whatever, moisture decreases the ability of tissue to tolerate pressure. Also, something known as friction and shear, which is real common because many nursing home patients lie down in bed. And so we tend to just pull them back up while the moist skin and the sheet creates a certain amount of friction. And this can also lead to disruption of the integrity. And I can talk more about that later. But there are also intrinsic factors. This are things from within, like how has the person been eating? There are some nutritional things that are particularly important. Other things could be increased age. People sometimes have changes, well, mostly have changes to the skin and the subcutaneous tissue. But other things would be factors that influence blood flow and blood pressure. So things like if a person has a low blood pressure, if they are other hypothetical factors beyond the arterial pressure would be emotional stress. We know that stress is related to increase in pressure ulcers. Smoking certainly is a factor. And skin temperature. All of these things are not necessarily included in the brain scale, but we do look for both intrinsic and extrinsic factors, and we do try to quantify nutrition.
Gotcha. That all makes sense. There's, there's so many factors. I think you said like 54 factors or something like that. So let's
yeah, maybe after.
Yeah, at least. So. So take me through then, in terms of once you have your RN or your CNA, or whoever it is, it's crunching numbers or whatever the case may be. What's the end of the, at the end of the day, what's the result? Is it a score? And if it's a score, what does it mean? If, is it a, is, you know, how is the rating actually computed?
So let me say, the other feature of this is what I told you about were just the main risk factors. Then we tend to quantify them from 1 to 4 so that we have a descriptor that shows about the increasing severity. A score of 1 is like the lowest. This would be, for instance, unconsciousness, a person that just could not, is not conscious, or they have no ability to feel pain. That would be a score of 1. Score of 4 might be their sensory abilities are perfectly intact. They can both feel discomfort, and if they need to, they can call someone. So on that subscale score, a person would get a score from 1 being the lowest to 4. For each of the subscales, we attempt to quantify in this manner from lowest to highest. Meaning the lowest score here is the greatest amount of risk. So at the end of the whole assessment, when we go subscale by subscale, we come up with a total score. And the final total points are 23. I think I just said that wrong. Anyway.
If it's not that, then it's close to it. I think it gets.
It's 21.
Yeah.
It's 21. I'm sorry. 21. So the final score possible would be 21. So someone that has scores from 18 to 21, we figure are not too much at risk for pressure ulcer. We call this mild risk. This does not mean people with higher scores, like from 21 to 23, the maximum possible, could not get a pressure ulcer. It's just they're less likely to. But we need to consider all the individual subscale scores, because in the end, we're going to make our care plan based on the score, the subscale score.
That makes sense.
Okay, so let me just say scores of like 13 to 15 would be considered moderate. Score from 10 to 12 would be considered high risk, and 9 and below, 9 to 6 would be very high risk. And so that type of scoring really only helps you to understand who probably needs the most attention right away. But that doesn't mean that people with even higher scores don't need specific attention. If the nutrition is terrible and you see that in the subscale score, that would be something that would be implemented.
Wow. Okay. So as Dr. Bergstrom is talking about the different categories, and then within those categories, the scoring process of being 1 through 4, and then crunching those numbers and coming up with an ultimate score, which would assign you as a high, medium, or mild risk for pressure ulcer development. It sounds like this complicated process. However, if you've actually seen one of these documents, and I would recommend that if your loved one is in a nursing home, you have the full right to review medical records. You can ask for them. You can ask for the care plan. And within the care plan and within the assessments, you can actually get this document if they're in fact using the Braden scale, which they probably are. But you'll be amazed at, despite what seems to be an extremely complicated set of variables, that the way Dr. Bergstrom and Dr. Braden have laid this test out, laid the assessment out, it's actually quite user-friendly. So I can imagine, Dr. Mm-hmm. Bergstrom, that was very difficult to go from here are the 54 factors, or here are the thousands of things that could be, okay, that could put you at risk. Here we are, we're going to weight it and we're going to scale it, but also make it easy for the person that's doing the assessment to understand it, because not everybody is a medical doctor. So that's
right.
Can you speak to that? Like, how difficult was that?
Well, you know, we try to make it simple, so that most people could use it. In fact, we tried it in 3 different nursing home trials before we ever published the paper for the first time. We found that the tool could be fairly reliably used. That is, people picking up the tool for the first time. If 2 people compared their results after reading the words and scoring someone they knew, this was fairly reliable if it was to RN. But we found that nursing assistants, and to some degree LVN, because if they didn't know the subject and hadn't had training, just could not be quite as accurate because there are some nuances in the tool that a trained person would need to understand. So there are training, there are ways people can train staff to improve their ability to score with tools. And we recommend that that facilities that are going to use this tool also work out what they're going to do for the interventions related to each subscale score.
Exactly. So let me ask this. So we've been talking about using this assessment tool as a means of helping put into place a care plan. At the beginning of the stay, at the admission, but and correct me if I'm wrong, but typically this assessment would need to be done either on a regular basis or particularly after maybe a change of condition. So, for example, if the individual develops a pressure ulcer in spite of having this assessment done in the care plan put in place, can you speak to how often should a facility be doing this type of assessment?
Yes, let me say, first of all, we think this should be done right from admission, because after all, it's about care planning. You're not trying to predict if they're going to get a pressure ulcer. You're trying to plan the care this person needs so they do not get one. So we have always said it should be done right on admission as soon as possible. And then we recommend, because there are things the person loves, the nurse won't know. They don't know how they eat. How well they eat at that point. They don't know if they're going to be incontinent, that kind of thing. So we recommend that this also be reassessed a day or two later. And then at the end of the first week, as you really have a fuller understanding of what this person is able to do and what their needs might be. And so we have this recommendation that we've made, and I don't know how firmly is it followed, but it would also then go on to say it'd be good to evaluate them at the end of the month and then quarterly, whenever the MDS records are updated. But there are caveats to this. So once you assess somebody, when do you need to reassess? And this would be the same, no matter if they're at home or they're in a nursing home or in ICU. And that would be when there is a change in condition. So change in condition could be something like the person stops eating for a couple days. You know, somebody may stop for a day and may just have a small amount of water or something, or juice. But if this persists for more than a couple days, we need to jump right in there and start improving the nutrition in one way or another. So. We do think that's one change. Another would be, are they running a fever? Or in older people, sometimes they get real hypothermic. And so when their blood pressure gets low, that would be another change of condition. If they have a cold or the flu, or they're discharged to a hospital, or there's some big shock in their life, the loss of a loved one causing extreme stress. All those things might mean that we should reassess and look at whether or not that person, the person's risk has changed.
That makes sense. If I understand you correctly, you talked about it's important, and obviously there's no set standard that they have to do. It's just if they do it, but at least within the first 48 hours, preferably by the end of that first week. Maybe by the end of the month of that first month, and then quarterly along with, and just for the listeners, we have had an episode or two about the MDS, which is a minimum data set, which is kind of like an assessment that's required by the nursing home if they want to get Medicaid and Medicare money, where they go through and they document and they assess not just skin integrity, but other factors of the care required for that resident. But you're saying, if I understand Dr. Bergstrom, that you would need to do it again then And then, you know, so quarterly after that. So that makes sense.
Yep. But big thing is it should be right on admission. I did a study with a couple of master's students one year where we're going to look at mattresses. And the mattress overlays that were supposed to be coming didn't arrive until like 48 hours later, at which time a large number of the residents already had some skin changes. And so, you know, it's important to just get in right away and do the assessment and start the care planning immediately.
Yeah, and I think that at least some people have heard you, because within the last couple of years, CMS is now requiring a baseline care plan and assessment be done within 48 hours, which was not always the case. Usually before that, it is my understanding that the nursing homes had 2 weeks, which a lot of things can happen in a shift, let alone 2 weeks.
Yeah. That's for sure. And especially when people go into a nursing home rehab centers, sometimes they're under a great deal of stress in that first week. You have to look at this. So if they've been in the hospital and they've had major surgery or a stroke or something, they're there for rehabilitation, then a pretty high cortisol level. And this is a predisposing factor to developing pressure ulcers. So we need to really pay close attention. Also, the psychological stress of going to a nursing home for the first time, where people are wondering, what am I doing here? How long am I going to be here? You know, all of this, I think, adds to a layer of stress in the first 2 weeks. And so we need to pay a lot of attention to people while we're getting to know them.
That makes sense. Thank you for that. So in the last few minutes, Dr. Bergstrom, you had mentioned a couple things that I think are extremely interesting, which I think that, at least for me, it would not have been apparent to me before I got into this line of work. But you mentioned blood pressure and body temperatures as possible risk factors for pressure ulcer development. Can you kind of explore that a little bit? What is that correlation?
Well, low blood pressure, actually, in a lot of older people have low blood pressure. The blood just isn't being pushed effectively through the vascular system. And so sometimes they're even colder and so forth. So that reduced blood flow can be a risk factor of sorts. I will say we were surprised also to find that high blood pressure, that is not even high, like 130 or more, was somewhat protective for developing pressure ulcers, but it's not going to save the day, you know. It's somewhat protective. Those become factors. If the temperature is increased a lot, this tells you that the individual may have an infectious process going on. But it also indicates that there can be some metabolic changes. The metabolism may actually increase to meet the needs of the body during an infectious inflammatory process. So this also becomes a risk factor. Can I add one thing that I would like to say to families of nursing home residents? Do you mind?
Go ahead. Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So you talked in a previous podcast about nursinghomes.gov, and I would like to say that in looking for nursing homes, one of the quality measures that are reflected on nursinghome.gov is the incidence of pressure ulcers in nursing facilities. So that's a good place for anybody to look if they're wondering about the nursing home their family member is in, how that compares to the state and the nation in terms of statistics. And one other personal note is that family members play a really important part in pressure ulcer prevention just by their presence and by the questions they ask. And so it is important to be involved. When my mother was in a nursing home, she had multi-invasive dementia. I lived in Nebraska, she was in Michigan. What can you do about that? And the answer in my case was a member of her church visited her every single day and did skin assessment for me. And the nursing home did not like this. She would turn my mother and look at her back and look at her heels and help feed her until I explained, she is my agent. She is my eyes and ears because I cannot be there. So I think this is a big, important part in helping nursing home residents and helping staff who even do really want to take good care of patients. But if they have another set of hands around, another set of eyes, this is also useful.
Thank you for sharing that story. I mean, that's, and also thank you for having listened to another episode. We're flattered by that.
I've listened to 4 episodes.
Well, thank you very much. So yes, and I'm glad that you said that, because typically I like to ask what family members can do with the information that you've provided. And that's one of the reoccurring themes, is be active, involved to the extent that you can get people moving around, do that. So thank you for that. I think that's something that people don't realize, that even at the end of the day, we talked about this in the last podcast, where even that it has a psychological effect, where if you're there, that's from a spiritual, from an emotional standpoint, when you got somebody there that's in your corner, I don't know, it's like your body does better. Your whole, the physiological component of it, I think you have a better chance when you have somebody that's your cheerleader.
Yeah, I agree with that. And it's not bad to ask what the Braden Scale score is and what they're doing. Not every facility uses the Braden Scale, but they should have some form of assessment and be able to tell you what they're doing by way of care plan to prevent problems.
That's exactly right. That's what we, and for listeners that are interested, we've had a podcast about how to, first of all, how to know who's doing what. So, excuse me. So who to ask the questions to, then if you get any kind of pushback, which hopefully you won't, but if you do, you can, how to politely through a written request order, get the records. And from the records, understanding how to read the records. And as Dr. Bergstrom said, you are perfectly allowed, absolutely allowed, if you're your loved one's representative, to get that information. It's not like it's protected. If you are the actual representative, you can ask what is the assessment, and based on if the person is a high risk, low risk, what are you guys doing? What are the what's called interventions that you guys are doing in order to prevent this? So that's super important information. And Dr. Bergstrom, thank you so much for sharing your story, sharing your information. You know, we talk about the Braden Scale often on this program, and it's just an honor to have somebody that developed the thing to be on here. So we appreciate your time, and thank you so much.
Certainly. Thank you for inviting me.
And again, the Braden Scale is universally used by many nursing homes. So again, we're super happy to have had Dr. Bergstrom on, who was a part of the process of creating and implementing this and doing the studies behind it. What a great person. You know, it's always great to have experts on this program to talk about these things. Obviously Will and I can't do it all by ourselves or anything like that. So it's good to have a conversation with the people that are behind the tools that we talk about on this program. So hats off to her. If you enjoy the content, be sure to like and subscribe wherever you get your podcast from. It would also help us if you, if you're watching this on the YouTubes, to subscribe and like, leave a comment if you enjoyed it. New episodes twice a month, I believe. Yeah. Every other week, new episodes for the time being. At any rate, my name is Rob. And on behalf of Will, my law partner, who's usually my co-host, and Dr. Bergstrom, we will see you next time.
Thanks for tuning in to the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast. Nothing said in this podcast, either by the host or the guest, should be construed as legal advice. nor is intended to create an attorney-client relationship between the host or their guest and the listener. New episodes are available every Monday on Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, or on your favorite podcast app, as well as on YouTube and our website, nursinghomeabusepodcast.com. Again, that's nursinghomeabusepodcast.com. See you next time.